I guess my first question is, can you simply introduce yourself and the organizations you belong to and what kind of political perspective you're coming from?
Sure. So my name is Alex DeChanu. I'm here in Hamilton going to McMaster University, and I guess I wear a few caps, so I'll be speaking in a personal capacity today, but I'm a member of QB 3906, which is the local of TAs and RAs that was on strike. I'm on the executive as the grievance officer. And I'm also a member of a Hamilton, or the Hamilton branch of an Ontario-wide anarchist organization called Common Cause.
Okay, thank you, Alex. Can you discuss why the TA and RA union at McMaster's was on strike, for how long, and the particular grievances that led to the strike action?
Well, there were a number of issues in terms of monetary issues. Wages wasn't one of them. The main one was benefits. We have very few benefits, and actually the benefit fund, we have sort of two forms of benefits. One is the dental, which is partly employer paid, and then there's another set of benefits which comes out of a union administered fund where we just get a lump sum from the employer to administer that, and that was a big issue because we've been getting more and more members as more grad students were coming to the university, and the money just wasn't covering the need. This is things like vision, child care, a hardship fund, and a UHIP rebate. And yeah, the money that was currently coming in wasn't covering that need as our membership grew. So that was one thing, was that more money in this sort of lump sum payment to cover those gaps. The other issues are more around quality of education. There was three in particular. One was to put some sort of a cap or at least some sort of disincentive on the size of tutorials. I'm not sure if it's the same thing in Nova Scotia, but in Ontario, tutorials are getting to be, especially in the social sciences and humanities, quite large. Whereas before, these, you know, 15, 20 people, now it's pretty common to have 25, 30. We've even heard as much as 80 people per tutorial, which is really getting to the size of a lecture. So that was, we were trying to first aim for a cap and then some kind of a disincentive structure so that these tutorials would be reduced over time. Because right now, the more students per tutorial, per TA, the more money the university receives from the government. So we're trying to reverse that kind of incentive structure. The other two major ones were, there was fifth year TA ships for fifth-year PhDs. Most PhDs, even though the programs are structured to finish in 4 years, most of us usually take around 5, even 6 years. And so normally, at least a few years ago, those upper-year PhDs would receive a TA ship. What's been happening recently, they've been hiring undergrad TAs, and there's a very good reason they've been doing that is because undergrad TAs are about, I think they pay about $23 an hour versus $38 an hour for graduate TAs. So this was setting it up that the TAs with the most experience were not being hired, while those with the least experience were being hired simply because it's cheaper. So that was another quality of education issue. Trying to think of the third one. It's skipping my mind right now. Just give me 1 second.
Okay.
Oh, intuition, of course. There was we're facing, for the past few years now, there's been an increase in tuition, so the maximum that the McMaster can increase tuition, which is about, it ranges from 4 to 8% depending on the category, if you're an undergrad, grad, or international student. And so this year, again, the university raised tuition, so we were trying to get that tuition raise rebated for all our members. And actually, there is one more issue, which was the number of hours that TAs are paid for. At the McMaster, we're paid for 130 hours per semester. And in a lot of departments, again, especially in the social sciences and humanities, we've been finding that it's just not possible with the number of students to do our jobs under or by 130 hours. Most of us work over that time, and that's just unpaid time that we just donate to the university in order to, you know, in order to feel like we're doing what's right by the students. So there's a demand to increase that from 130 to 140 hours. So those are the main issues. So yeah, benefits and these four, I guess, quality of education issues.
And when was the strike exactly?
The strike began on Monday, November 6th. Oh, sorry, Monday, November 2nd. Sorry, Monday, November 2nd. And it lasted until Monday, November 9th. So just a week.
And what events led up to this strike?
Well, we've been bargaining. Our contract ran out August 31st, and bargaining had gone on. Well, it sort of got on. It started in the summer, but it was very clear from the beginning that McMaster University was not interested in bargaining. They sort of presented this offer, and they said, you know, pretty much take it or leave it. And it's kind of stalled all the way to the strike deadline. The union had gotten a strike mandate from the membership, and after going through all the other steps, you know, having a mediator from the government come in and that, and having some marathon bargaining, it was still clear that the employer was simply stalling. I mean, they tabled the same offer over and over again, I think about five times, while we on the other side were compromising and sort of reducing our offer, you know, relaxing some of our demands. But it was pretty clear that this was the offer they were going to make, and unless something changed. So at that point, the bargaining team decided to call a strike. And actually, we did hold, just before we called the strike, there was a general membership meeting where some of our members had asked, you know, to put this the employer's package to ratification vote, and the membership voted 2-1 to not even consider the offer. So that's, you know, the bargaining team felt empowered by that, and the next day we called a strike. I should say the bargaining team called a strike. I wasn't on the bargaining team, even though I'm on the executive.
And what roles did you play during the strike?
I was one of the picket captain coordinators. So, I mean, that basically means making sure you're overseeing the picket lines. In our case, we have three picket lines. So you're making sure everyone stays safe. You're dealing with police. You're dealing with, you know, directing media to the right people, making sure there's enough people on the picket lines so it's safe, making sure there's picket captains and they have training, you know, supplying the picket lines. People got to get their coffee, their hot soups, and this sort of thing. So just, you're basically in a van all day running around from picket line to picket line, making sure everyone's okay. And also you're just any negotiations with the university or the police in terms of how the strike's going, security issues, that kind of thing. You're in charge of that. So that was me and a few other people that that did that. And then, of course, the other role was, you know, after the end, we had 12-hour pickets. After that was, as everybody else was involved, was on the executive meeting, you know, long meetings after that, you know, just addressing the issues, what's been happening at the bargaining table, and this sort of thing. So, yeah, it was only a week, but it was, you know, 15 to 18-hour days every day. So it was pretty intense.
And can you describe the turnout at the pickets during the strike?
Yeah, I mean, the turnout was, we have to look at it two ways. It wasn't great in terms of the size of our membership. I mean, we had an average about, you know, anywhere 75 to 100 TAs per shift. So about, you know, anywhere around 300 a day, I'd say, that came out. So it's not a huge portion of our membership. Although to us, it was still quite impressive because, I mean, part of the background for this is that as a union, this particular unit, anyway, the TAs and RAs have not been particularly strong. There's been a lot of apathy. Some sort of, you know, being a TA union, you get all kinds of members, some quite conservative, some quite ideologically anti-union. But the main issue was apathy. And but, I mean, so in that context, having even 300 people come out to the line, I mean, this is a union that hasn't gone on strike since 1999. And a union that just in 2006 voted to accept another bad offer without even, rather than go on strike. So when the bargaining team made that decision to go on strike, they made it with a strike mandate. But to be honest, we weren't 100% sure that people would show up to the picket lines. You know, they sort of gambled that solidarity could be built on the picket lines. And it did to the extent that we were able to, you know, run effective pickets. We were able to do it for 12 hours a day, from 7:30 to 7:30 p.m. And, yeah, just run effective pickets. And that was, well, the numbers seem small overall. Our membership are 2,700 overall. But given the context, given the history of the local, that in some ways It might appear weak, but I don't think the local's ever been stronger. So,
would you describe the overall political culture on McMaster's as apathetic?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, if there's any sort of politics, it's usually very conservative. It kind of runs from the top, you know, with the president who's on record as being for tuition deregulation, right down to, you know, the student unions. It's a very, I mean, it's conservative, but mostly it's apathetic. Like, I think an engaged, informed membership could very easily deal with a small minority of, like, deeply anti-union or conservative members. The problem is we're just not there yet. It's still very, well, apathetic, but also, I mean, being grad students, people are generally very busy, especially in the sciences and engineering, where they're expected to work, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week in labs and modern experiments. It doesn't give much time for politics. But that said, I mean, the strike really did mobilize more people than ever on this campus. And if it didn't mobilize everybody, at least it forced everybody to really look at their own values, look in the mirror, consider politics, consider getting involved, and just generally interrupted this sort of deafening silence of apathy that usually characterizes McMaster. I mean, this is as far opposite from a place like York University as you can get.
Can you describe, I guess, a day on the picket and discuss the solidarity that was experienced on the picket lines?
Yeah, that'd be my pleasure. I mean, that was the most meaningful and worthwhile thing of the whole experience, was the kind of communities that grew around these picket lines. I mean, as TAs, we're generally very isolated and fragmented. We barely know the people in our own departments. And here on a picket line, you're able to get to know people from all across the university that otherwise you would never have known. And all kinds of, you know, really interesting things start to happen. You start discussing politics, the politics of McMaster, the politics of your department, politics in general. You build solidarity, you know, you're looking out for each other, you're dealing with angry drivers together. You know, just simple things like sharing coffee, sharing a cup of soup. I think people felt for the first time, maybe at McMaster, certainly for me for the first time, that outside of my small circle of friends, that there was a bigger community out there, and it was really exhilarating to experience that. I only wish it would have gone on longer, because I think things were just getting really interesting on the lines in that first week. But even that short period of time, I think everyone who walked on those picket lines, now when they walk on campus, they feel different. They feel less isolated. They know there's a small but growing community out there, people who share their same values. And we know that having those values, we're not as isolated as we thought. It just took something like a strike to bring us out all together in common struggle. So I think that alone made the experience worth it.
Were there any particular political conversations you had while on the pickets that you're going to remember for a long time?
I mean, I think a lot of people, not sure there's one, I mean, there was a lot of fun had with Mark Haley, which is the chief negotiator on the union, on the university side, and assistant vice president of human resources. He's quite a character. I mean, just downright, he's a bully. And at one point, he actually came to our picket lines on the first day of the strike and started getting in the face of our members who were exercising their legal right to strike, and even at one point grabbed a police officer's arm and told them they're not doing their job. That caused quite a bit of conversation, just because I think a lot of people just did not think that there was somebody in the senior administration who looked upon TAs in such a condescending matter. And I think for a lot of people that was kind of like a wake-up call, that really we're not much to this university other than cheap academic labor. We're there to give the illusion of small classes. And, yeah, I think a lot of people, that was sort of a waking experience, too. In some ways, it was a gift by the senior VP to have done this, because I think it really woke a lot of us up to the nature of an employer, right? I mean, most academics, whether, you know, they're just starting out or later on think they're a pretty privileged group and expect a certain to be treated in a certain way, but it was clear that as TAs, I mean, we're contingent academic labor force, and we are seen as basic income units, which is how the McMaster budget documents refer to students, grad students, and TAs.
Can you say that again?
Basic income units. This is how McMaster talks about students and graduate students and TAs in their budget documents.
That's frightening.
Yes, it is. But we had some fun with it on their last sort of get-to-know McMaster day, where they bring high school students in and their parents. We walked around with big QB signs that said, "Welcome, basic income units," and had quite a lot of interesting conversations with parents about, you know, what education really looks like at McMaster and what they don't tell you in their glossy flyers.
I guess over the last year or so, we've seen a lot of political activity on university campuses around the world, with occupations in California, New York, Greece, and other actions all throughout Europe. Was any of this discussed on the picket lines or during the strike at all?
A little bit. I mean, I know like I said, I was running around a lot, but it's something that I personally made a point to bring up to really give people a sense that, you know, this is not an isolated instance. We're not alone in the struggle, that across the world, the university sector, the education in general is in crisis after, you know, decades of underfunding and neoliberal attacks, and the university becoming more and more like a corporation. And so, yeah, I mean, I try to bring up these other struggles from around the world that are happening, you know, in recent years and even as we speak. And, yeah, so it came up in that way. I'm not sure if others were talking about it, but I certainly had a sense of that, you know, this is a general crisis across the sector, and we're just one instance of it. And the fact that it was, you know, at a place like McMaster, we had a strike over it, I think says just how deep this crisis is. Because again, I would have never thought we'd see a strike at a place like McMaster, where generally people just accept these sort of negative changes and just kind of, you know, hope to move on in 3-4 years and have to deal with them.
When was the last strike at McMaster's?
As far as TAs, the last one was 1999.
So a decade ago.
Yeah, about a decade ago. And that was the only strike in 34 years that this union had.
Wow. I guess another question I have for you is, how did the strike interfere with the daily functioning of McMaster's? And did it have any economic impact on the university that you know of?
I don't have any numbers or anything like that specifically. I mean, I don't think it had that big of an impact, to be honest. I think one was, it was very short. Two, our picket lines were on purpose. They were not made to be really disruptive. I mean, we stopped cars for up to 5 minutes a car. But generally, since we were mostly, you know, slowing down traffic of other students and faculty, the point wasn't to have picket lines that were that disruptive. Also, for so many people, so many of our members, this was the first time ever on a line, and for many, the first few days, the idea of a strike was quite scary. The idea of blocking traffic was quite scary. So we weren't about to have really, at least in this first week, really disruptive militant picket lines. At one point, the steel worker showed up and sort of showed everybody how to do it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the local 1005 here, the steel workers, Stelco, they came and, you know, just literally, they actually just blocked traffic, and so nobody's getting through, and sort of commanded the respect that people, workers like steel workers, can get from, you know, from being on the picket lines, and from, you know, the police treat them very differently as well, especially in Hamilton. It's a steel town still, and so just kind of, you know, showed them what a militant picket looks like. But that wasn't the strategy that we were going for, since, by and large, I mean, those of us who would withdraw our labor, you know, nobody was doing our labor. Nobody was scabbing my particular tutorial. Just the nature of the work is that's not really an option. for the university to do that. So, I mean, a lot of departments canceled tutorials across the board. There was definitely a bigger impact in the social sciences and humanities, and less so in engineering and sciences, where a lot of TAs continue to work.
And what was the response to TAs who were scabbing?
Our approach was mainly just a moral one. You know, we explained to people why this is undermining our collective efforts, why you know, it's not the right thing to do. But there wasn't too much more beyond that we could have done. Again, I think the nature of the union, of this particular unit, the TAs and RAs, is that on one side you have a group of very committed, dedicated trade unionists. On the other side, you have a smaller group of very vocal, anti-union, sort of deeply conservative members that, you know, only pipe up when it comes time to, when we start talking about a strike or negotiations, and they're clearly on the side of the employer. And then you have this massive group of people in the middle that can go either way. They're mostly apathetic, but they can go either way. And so that's kind of what you have to keep your focus on when you're organizing in our union, is how to persuade this middle group. And so anything like a militant action against scabs and like that would have actually, you know, worked against us, I think.
These divisions within the union, what kind of lines are people's commitment to trade unionism based on their particular faculty or age or anything like that?
There's a big split. This strike revealed a big split between the sciences and engineering and social sciences and humanities. And there's some sort of underlying reasons for that. One is that the sciences have been have received a lot more funding from McMaster University in the past, and in the recent past. So some of the issues that we're fighting for, like overwork, tutorial sizes, were not issues in these departments to the same extent. There's also the nature of the work is a bit different. I think there's far less time for politics in the sciences. Again, there seems to be, at least in some departments, I'm not from the side of campus, so I don't know exactly, but seems that supervisors have a lot more sort of power over their students. There's an expectation that all you do is you sort of work in your lab, you know, up to 80 hours a week, and that's it. And it's almost like a ritual you have to pass through in order to prove yourself. We heard quite a few instances from that side of campus of supervisors, you know, basically breaking the law, saying, you know, telling people how to vote, telling people to scab, encouraging people to scab. Even heard of one person, I can't confirm this, but saying they'll give students extra marks if they cross the picket lines. Really stuff like that you can't really prove or do anything about, and anyway, it would just end up in the courts forever in any case. And you don't have that as much in the social sciences and humanities. That sort of pressure, and it's a real pressure. I mean, the supervisors can, without being able to respond, they can, for example, rank you at the bottom of the scholarship application, meaning, you know, you don't get NSERC and some of these other bigger scholarships, and there's nothing to stop them from doing that. There's no way to prove that they're targeting you either. It's a sort of a closed process where they can just simply do that. And we actually do know of one person who, by anyone's standards, is a top student in his department, who, due to their union involvement, was ranked at the bottom of one of these scholarships, and so, of course, didn't get it, which, you know, is a difference of tens of thousands of dollars of income for the rest of his remainder if he chooses to pursue further graduate school. So there's those kinds of issues, I think. But despite that, I think, not a lot, but a handful of the sciences did come out. I think a lot of them did change their mind. I think up, you know, in the hundreds, I think did change their mind as the strike went on. And as we had these sort of meetings and where people heard the words like solidarity and community for the first time and heard the appeal to solidarity from campus, from the other side of campus. And again, that was another one of the really rewarding things about this. It's, you know, it took a strike, but it sparked a debate that otherwise would have never happened. And for a lot of people, maybe this is the first time they'd ever been in that kind of situation where they had to defend their values, think about their values, and just generally be part of a bigger community that was was asking you to become part of this community, as opposed to just thinking on a narrow individual basis. And a lot of people, not enough in the end for us to win the kind of contract we wanted, but quite a few, enough for me to make it worthwhile, did change their mind and did come to the picket lines. I think that was kind of the victory within this, what was overall a defeat.
Did you see any expressions of solidarity from other workers on campus or students on campus?
Oh, for sure. There's a whole bunch of other union locals on campus. There's, but the two that really stood out during the strike were the SEIU, which were sort of the cleaner and facility services people. They came out every lunchtime. They spent their entire lunch hour with us on the picket lines. The CW on campus as well, their members were out. There's a couple undergrad committees that formed, a sort of a solidarity committee. Overall, I think the undergrads were, like the rest of the campus, apathetic. Probably a majority were annoyed with the strike, not simply the extent of it. It was an inconvenience. But a small group of really dedicated, really amazing people, undergrads, did come out, and they were there every day, and they were supporting us, and they were handing out flyers trying to educate their fellow undergrads. And some of the, you know, Hamilton is a labor town, so we got a lot of support from the Hamilton District Labor Council. And, like, for example, the bus drivers, they would refuse to cross our picket lines, both the city buses as well as the intercity buses. So they would, they rearrange the stops so they wouldn't have to come out to campus in order to pick up students. That's one of the more concrete forms of solidarity that we saw.
Did you see any solidarity from outside the Hamilton area, from outside Southern Ontario?
I think there was, you know, letters sent, solidarity greetings, this sort of thing. A few people from other universities in the sector, mostly in Southern Ontario, but, you know, places like York and University of Toronto, OISE, they came down with us on the picket lines. But it's mostly just in the form of solidarity greetings.
And can you describe, I guess, the end of the strike, the vote that took place, and the current agreement?
Sure. So, like I mentioned, the membership had decided to, in a general membership meeting, not to even consider the offer, not to have a ratification vote. But about, you know, as the strike went on, after the first few days, it became really apparent that the employer was not going to budge, that they were going to basically wait us out on the picket lines. And the fact that our picket lines were not as strong as they should have been given the size of our membership, given, you know, 2,700 members, they were not going to budge. And we also had this sort of, again, a small sort of fringe group of anti-union members who were really agitating to have a ratification vote. And even though the membership had voted not to do that, they were sort of not dropping the issue, and they were talking in the media, you know, going on our blog and this sort of thing. And so really, I think the bargaining team came to the conclusion that to have this vote, and with the idea that it would be voted down, and then it would take care of both the employer, I mean, it forced the employer to, or at least put a lot of pressure on the employer to come back with a better offer, and also sort of silence this group of anti-union TAs. And we knew that it was going to be risky. We knew there was a chance that the membership would accept it. But we felt like that was the only way to gain some leverage over the employer and try to move things forward. So also we felt, you know, once the membership had voted this offer down, then that would bring more people to the picket lines. I mean, what we're really hoping for is a mass meeting, over 1,000 people, ideally, where we could have this debate. And we were really confident that if we could get people to come out to this meeting, then we can change people's minds. Just like the meeting before we went on strike, the mood in the room at the beginning was I think 2-1 anti-union, or at least anti going out on strike. But from the kind of debate that happened, the appeals of solidarity that took place, a lot of that room completely changed its mind. It went 2-1 in favor of going on strike. So that's what we were hoping would happen again. So we call this the ratification vote. And the way that's structured is you first have a general membership meeting, then there's voting immediately after the meeting, as well as voting the day following, all day long. And unfortunately, the turnout to the meeting was abysmal. There was I think only like about 200 people showed up, most of which were already engaged with the issues on both sides of the issue. So really that main group of people, that mass in the middle that was on the fence, many of whom were not on the picket lines but weren't scabbing either. They were simply at home hoping the issue would go away, did not come out. And part of that was, you know, the university was very smart. They messaged that, you know, you don't have to come to this union meeting to vote, and we'll even provide buses for you the next day to take you to the voting station and back. And that's what they did. They ran these shuttle buses, but you know, all day long from 10 to 5 p.m., bringing people to vote. And you know, the joke was, you know, we were going to turn these what we called scab expresses into solidarity expresses, and we did everything we could. We handed out flyers on the buses. We lined the bus route with solidarity messages. But in the end, you know, 58% of the voters still, of our members still decided to accept the contract. So it was close, to be honest. I think that in itself was a little surprising how close it was, given that very few people came to the meeting and many people were voting without really being informed. I mean, I was handing out flyers to people getting on the bus, and many still did not know that by accepting this offer, they'd be losing benefits and seeing a reduction in things like vision care. So, but I mean, like I said, in the end, they chose to accept it, and that ended the strike.
And can you tell us what you guys have lost because you signed that agreement?
Yeah, so, well, in terms of take-home pay, because of the tuition increases, even though we got, and I believe it's an 85-cent raise per year, or no, 85 cents in the first year, and 55 cents per year, or sorry, 85 cents in year one and 55 cents in year two of the contract, the two-year contract. Even though we got that raise, it doesn't make up for the loss that as a result of the tuition increase. So every member is looking at around $300 to $400 lost over the course of the contract due to this agreement in wages. And if you're an international student, it's closer to $2,000 because they were hit with much higher a tuition increase, double the rate of everybody else. In terms of benefits, well, we made, the employer is making an extra $3 per member contribution to the dental plan. We're seeing the elimination of the hardship fund. There's a fund that was, you know, for members in hardship could apply for $500 a year to sort of, you know, help them pay the next month's rent, that kind of thing, in case some emergency had come up. That's been lost. Our meager child care fund was lost. That was $100 a year. It was more like a token fund, but it was there in order to sort of plant a seed and have it keep growing. But that's been stamped out with this agreement. Also, the UHIB rebate has been reduced. That was something we provided to our international students, so who are not covered on the Ontario Healthcare Act. They have to buy this this other insurance called UHIP, and it's quite a bit. It's $800 a year per individual. I think it's $2,000 per year for family coverage. So we'd offered a small, I think, $100 rebate towards that. That's been reduced as well. So those are the sort of main monetary losses. And then, of course, none of the quality of education issues were addressed. So we're still going to see tutorial sizes keep growing. This year, PhDs won't have access to TA-ships. You know, tuition will keep increasing, and we're not going to have an increase in the hours of work from 130 to whatever that number would be. So it's still going to be a lot of unpaid overtime. But yeah, that was the consequences, and you know, it's a bad agreement. It breaks with the pattern in the sector. So it also means that other TAs at other universities in Ontario are now going to have to be faced with the same kind of agreement. from this sort of class of university administrators. And that'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because I think it's going to mean a lot more strikes. Because, I mean, even if a place like McMaster went on strike over it, I can only imagine other places where maybe there's a bit more militancy, a bit more engagement. So we'll see how it plays down. I mean, it doesn't feel good knowing that you're the one who sort of established this new pattern, but hopefully, you know, others can fight it off, and we'll get a chance at it again in 2 years' time. I think we'll be facing the exact same struggle, exact same issues 2 years from now. So we've got 2 years to, you know, build the unity in the union that's is missing right now.
What kind of organizing do you think you're going to need to do in order to win 2 years down the line?
Well, it's clear we have to go into the sciences and engineering and really talk to people and really find out what their issues are and some of the pressures they're facing, and also, you know, put a little bit of fear into some of these supervisors who are pressuring their students, you know, to come out against the union. But mainly, I think it's just educating people about the role of a union, about solidarity, about, you know, standing in solidarity with others across the campus. Just that kind of engagement. I think it's totally possible. I mean, it's going to take a lot of work, and we've always known this is our weakness. It's just there's nobody ever to do that kind of work. It's the hardest work there is. It requires hours upon hours of knocking on doors, having one-on-one conversations. You know, a blog helps, but it won't do on its own. And, you know, up to now, this union's been a dozen people carrying all the workload, so that number has to increase for us to do this kind of work. I think the good news is that the strike has increased that number. I think there's a whole new batch of union activists that were not there before that are now going to be involved. I mean, one of the challenges is the turnover that comes with being a TA union. Every 3-4 years, the core of your membership leaves. But I think with this strike, we've built up the next core of leaders that are going to take over from us. Because a lot of people on strike were first-year PhDs. A lot of people that became radicalized and politicized were first-year PhDs. So they're here for another 3-4 years. So I think, like, and even though we lost, I think this leaves us stronger than before. I mean, no doubt we're going to be facing also a stronger employer and an emboldened employer. But also as a union, we have more activists than before. We have a stronger leadership core than before. So I think we can do it. I mean, one thing the strike has done right away is that after the strike ended, there was a lot of anger with how it ended, and people have started taking sort of grassroots resistance to the contract in the form of a kind of a work to rule where people are saying, you know, if my contract is 130 hours, then I'm not going to go a minute over. And the culture at McMaster has been that you do go over, and you go over, and you're unpaid for those hours, and you do it out of you know, dedication to your students. I think that's changed, at least among the people that were on the picket lines. And you can see that clearly in a whole bunch of departments, especially in the social sciences and humanities. People are saying, I'm not working a minute over my contract hours. And that has to do also with the back-to-work protocol, which was very punitive. We were docked, so we were on strike for a week, and we were docked 10 hours work for being on strike. Now that would be sort of normal. You know, we get paid on average 10 hours a week, so that in most workplaces that'd be normal. That's what you would expect. Except the nature of our work is that you can make up hours lost in 1 week, the following week or the following weeks. And the pattern has been at in the sectors, when you do go on strike, you make up those hours later on because somebody still has to do that marking. Somebody still has to do those office hours, that student consultation. To give you an example, at York, the strike went for 3 months, and they still received 90% of their contract hours, so 90% of their pay. At McMaster, we were on strike for 1 week, and we're being docked almost 8% of our pay. So it's really, again, it breaks the pattern. It's punitive. It was simply, you know, a way of the McMaster saying, don't ever do this again. You know, kind of like, you know, treating us like children again. Although it's backfiring, because now people are starting, there's going to be, you know, the grievance committee that the union has is growing rapidly as people want to pursue this issue through the grievance process, but also people are doing a lot of informal resistance in their departments to this, whether it's writing letters to department chairs demanding that these 10 hours hour loss be given back, people refusing to work over their contract hours, people handing back unfinished exams, unfinished papers that they couldn't mark, and saying, "Too bad, I'm not doing it. My hours is up, and you just cut 10 hours from my contract. So, either pay me overtime, give me extra hours, or I'm not doing it." And that's something that we've always wanted to see. Like, I've always wanted to do some kind of campaign like that, because I think in many ways it could be even more effective than a strike on this particular issue of the hours of work. But there was never the energy and the sort of the politics behind it, the culture. And this strike has definitely changed that, at least on one side of the campus. So, again, that's that sort of victory or the positive that comes within this sort of greater defeat that we suffered.
I have one more question for you, Alex, and then I guess we can wrap up. I was wondering if you could discuss how your involvement in the strike is tied to your anarchist political perspective.
Sure. I guess in a number of ways. I mean, the kind of anarchism that I follow is sort of rooted in the historical, sort of classical tradition of anarchism, going back 150 years to the First International with, Karl Marx and Mikhail Bakunin. And so that was, this tradition has always been rooted in and aims to be rooted in struggles of the working class, whether it's in the workplace or in the community or against struggles against various forms of oppression. So I've always been interested, based on these politics, in doing what I call organizing work. Work organizing where you're at, organizing with your coworkers, your neighbors, and organizing on issues that affect you directly, as opposed to what I've kind of come to call more activist-y type things, which is sort of the opposite of that. It's mostly organizing with other activists who are already politicized, on issues that don't directly impact you necessarily, or it could be the same issue, but you approach it in a way that, like, it could be environmental issues, it could be save the whales, as opposed to do something about the steel plant in my backyard, that kind of thing. So a different approach. So for me, it was only natural as an anarchist, as a class struggle anarchist, that I would be involved in my union, helping to organize my coworkers, and helping take on capitalism from where I find myself inserted into it, which at this point happens to be in the education factory, in the university. And I also think this method is, I saw it with my own eyes. I think for me, for my first time, is what works. It's how you build movements. Because, it's great to be a group of activists, and a lot of good work gets done that way, but I find often it's hard to break out of that sort of bubble. The activist bubble tends to form around a particular scene, but when you organize your coworkers, you have, in order to have any chance of succeeding, you have to educate and create new activists. You have to politicize people. It forces you to do that, whereas organizing a protest, that kind of thing, doesn't force you to do that. And that's one thing I really saw today. Some of the best organizers in this union, they're not radicals by any means, they're not anarchists or anti-capitalists, but they, through their hard work and putting in all the work that nobody else wanted to do and sacrificing for others, gained the respect of everybody else and therefore helped to politicize them. And I think there's a lot of lessons there for activists, for anti-capitalists, and certainly I think that's a lesson that I take from the particular anarchist tradition that I follow. So, and it was great to be able to sort of see it firsthand and apply it firsthand. And yeah, I look forward to many more struggles of this nature.
And is there anything else you think that needs to be said?
Well, in terms of, again, how this links to anarchism, I think we do have to, I think the workplace is still absolutely central. It's not the only site of struggle. There are others that are just as important, but I think again, the workplace, struggling along those kinds of issues is key. It brings together a diverse group of people, it politicizes people, and it allows us to hit back at the system of capitalism directly, right where we're at, and in many ways where we're strongest, because it is where we're at, we know how that particular system in that particular place, in this case the university, works, so we know how to hit back better than we would otherwise. So for me, you know, I know there's a lot of, in the sort of radical scene, there's not everywhere, but certainly a lot of people who have turned their back on the workplace, turned their back on unions in general, and there's a lot of good reason for that in terms of what many unions have become, sort of these bureaucratic business unions. But I think this, for me, shows me that it is possible to turn that around. It's possible to reform the kind of unions we have, to make them democratic, in our case, extremely democratic and militant. So, yeah, I guess I'd end on that.